Mrs. Mitchell, rewind. Where were you born, please?
In Munster, Westphalia.
And could we have your date of birth, please?
The 14th of June, 1929.
Can you tell me something about your family background, what your father did for a living and so on, please?
My father was an import and export grain merchant, and he was a successful businessman. He actually was born in a place called Bielefeld, but came to Munster and set up an office there. He was very well respected in the town. He closed his office, I think it was in 1937, because he felt he couldn't do business there anymore, and moved it actually into one room in our house in Munster, with a very small staff. He was the president of the finance director, chairman, and then the president of the community, Jewish community in Munster, which was the liberal community, which is more or less the equivalent of the Masorti movement here. It's a little to the right of the liberal movement and a little to the left of the conservative, of the reform movement. I mean, it's somewhere in between. And so he was very conscious of his German background, but very conscious of his Jewish background. And the town had about 600 Jewish inhabitants, who seemed to be the sort of middle-class Jews. And there were, of course, some people who were poorer in the community and who were well looked after by the community, I believe.
And your mother's background?
My mother's background, she was born in Berlin, and her mother died when she was very young, when she was two, I believe, in childbirth. And her father died, I think, in 1918. And she went to live with an aunt, whom I called Omi, because I didn't actually have any grandparents. And Omi moved with one of her daughters to Munster because she married the rabbi. Her name was Tode Steintal. My uncle was Fritz Steintal, rabbi, who eventually emigrated to the Argentine shortly after the Kristallnacht. And it was they emigrated to the Argentine because his brother was an engineer working for German railways. And they'd gone to the Argentine on business in the 1920s. So, and the two brothers married two sisters. And they were my parents' greatest friends. My mother, visiting her cousin Tula in Munster, sort of more or less a sister, older sister, caught chickenpox, I think, from her children. And on one of those days when she should have come back to Berlin, my father rang the doorbell, and this gorgeous young woman was stood there. And my father was 24 years older than my mother. It's quite an age difference. So then my mother, they got engaged, I think, a few weeks later, in 1927, and got married in July 1927. I think they got engaged on my father's birthday, which was May the 18th, because my father figured there was no point in hanging around, as he was already 44, I think, at the time. And she was 17. 42 at the time.
You were about 4 years old when Hitler took over.
Yes, indeed.
So your childhood in Germany was under the Third Reich.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like in Munster? What are your memories of living under the Hitler regime?
Well, really, it's quite hard to go back to it now, but I suppose I was conscious of the fact that things were happening. Although I've always taken my hat off to my parents from keeping us pretty secure. But there were certain things that happened domestically, for instance, where when the laws passed that no German family could have an employee under 45 years of age, we got a lovely cook called Ella Bolling. We used to call her Bolly. And the other one had to go, who was a very nice woman. I think her name was Hanna Rott. And we had... So I remember Bolly brought her little niece to play with me in the garden. And one day that little girl couldn't come play with me anymore because she went into whatever the girl equivalent is of the Hitler Youth. So she couldn't play with the little Jewish girl anymore. And Bolly was very upset about it, but she figured it. She had to look after the niece's interests, of course. And my father, for instance, had a very nice chauffeur whose great ambition was to become a flyer. And he once went to my father and said, "Would you mind if I joined on a sort of 3 days a week basis, evenings a week basis, the SA, because they said they'll teach me how to fly?" And my father said, "Of course I don't mind. What else could he say?" And this man, whose name was Kawa, joined this evening SA group and was immediately told that he couldn't work for a Jewish employer anymore, and said, was heartbroken, and said to my father, "You're the best employer I've ever had. I can't do it anymore." And from that day onwards, he drove the SS Gruppenführer in the town in his dirty big car with a swastika on, and we, Hans and I, my brother and I, went to a Jewish school, which my uncle was director of. My uncle, the rabbi, was director of. And I remember being slightly stroppy adult still, well, there you go. And I used to love it when Kawa used to pick us up in that car with a swastika and drove us to school. It didn't happen often, but I think it was his protest. And I thought it was quite something. I think looking back on it now, I think it's even more something than I thought at the time. Then I just enjoyed being in a beautiful open car with Kawa at the wheel. And so we also, when we were children, a small group of us who lived in the area, it was a nice residential area, a small group of us used to, my parents insisted that we should meet at the corner, I think of our street, of our corner, or whatever, and go to school together. They didn't want us to become spoiled little kids, so they weren't going to take us to school by car. But what I didn't realize till long afterwards, when I was here and lived here in England, was they had a rota of parents who followed us to school. Because we were obviously going to the Jewish school. And we were attacked on the way to school sometimes. And in fact, I have, if you want it, my brother sent it to me, two of the ditties they used to yell after us. I've got the words here. Jude, itzig, Nase, spitzig, Augen, eckig, Arschloch, dreckig. And another one. Tuff, tuff, tuff. Es kommt ein Kinderwagen. Tuff, tuff, tuff. Mit einem Jud gefahren, tuff, tuff, tuff. Wo will der Jude hin? Er will wohl nach Jerusalem, wo alle Juden sind. Schmeiß sie raus, die ganze Judenbande, schmeiß sie raus aus unserem Vaterlande, schmeiß sie nach Jerusalem und schneide ihnen beide Beine ab, dass sie nicht wiederkommen können. My singing is not exactly superb, but those were the two ditties that actually my brother remembered and sent to me. But I do remember them.
Can you give the gist in English, please?
The gist in English is, Jude Itzig, you know, Itzig was a sort of derogatory way of, you know, Jude Itzig was a derogatory expression referring to pointed nose, slitted eyes, and dirty arse. And the other one, tough, 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 is a way of saying, you know, somebody's coming along, tough, 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 is sort of, there's a pram coming along, which is being driven by a Jew. And where does the Jew want to go? He wants to go to Jerusalem, where all the Jews are. And the second verse says, "Throw them out, the whole Jewish crowd. Chuck them out, our fatherland. Chuck them to Jerusalem." And cut both their legs off so that they can't come back. That's the English translation.
Where do you think they came from?
I have no idea. I mean, you know, children make up ditties. And they used to have some of the Hitler Youth people having a go at it on the way to school. And we were obviously never in danger because, or let's put it this way, we were lucky enough not to. But we did a few fisticuffs with them. And then I once, on one occasion, thought it might be a good idea to raid our mother's pin boxes. We didn't tell them that we were going to do that. And when they started on us, I stuck pins and ran like hell. We didn't have too much trouble after that, rather than slug it out with them. But the other thing, which is rather unusual, for a little girl particularly, my dad had us taught boxing, my brother and I. We had a cottage by the river, sort of summer cottage by the river. and several times a week we had an instructor, and I can still remember his name. And because we had this very close connection to the community, I don't think we, you know, I certainly didn't suffer. I started getting scared in England when the war broke out, when I realized what might happen. But that was also after other experiences, which I'm sure you want to come to. With him was actually in Italy. Again, my mother, I don't think was there. And she used the opportunity of doing courses to prepare herself, you know, the sort of things that somebody who's really quite untrained might be able to do if they go to another country. And ironically, and funnily enough, because I've only started buying them recently, one of the things she learned how to make was silk flowers. That was the Jewish women of that age, who'd never done a damn thing in their lives, including housework, tried to go do something which would help them eventually, if they had to get out. And I remember these courses that my mother did. One of them, I think, was a beautician's course, and one was my flower mess. So she didn't use either, but boy, did she use the housework. But she never learned that. She did that by trial and error when we came here.
What was the name of the school that you went to?
Help.
Doesn't matter if you can't remember. Or the name of the street?
It was actually used to be a teacher's seminary for Jewish teachers. It was called the Max Heindorf Schule. And it was called the Max after a man called Max Heindorf, who was a philanthropist about 100 years earlier or something like that, and was originally called the Max Heindorf Stiftung, which is a trust. But the school was Max Heindorf Schule. But as I say, it was connected with the community, although the synagogue was not on the site. But there were assembly rooms, and for instance, after the synagogue was burned down in 1938, we used to meet in the school hall as a community.
Were you given any kind of religious upbringing?
Oh, yes. Well, we were very consciously Jewish. I mean, my parents did not keep a kosher household. My uncle did very much so. And I remember, first of all, we went to synagogue every week, either Friday and Saturday. And mother sang in the choir. And as I said, Daddy was the president of the community, so he had to come here. And he wanted to anyway. And we certainly had Friday nights at home always. The Friday night. And loved it. That was a very important part of it. But the Jewish memory, which I treasure, and which I suppose my first conscious Jewish memory, was the Seder night we spent at my uncle's, which we did every year. But the first time I was allowed to ask the four questions, the Mani Shtana. And it has stayed with me, that memory, every Seder I have attended since, that memory comes back, because I was allowed, it was exciting, my uncle made it beautiful. And I was the littlest one, and I was said the Mani Shtana, funnily enough, until I was 22 years old after that, because even after we were married, I was the youngest at the Seder here in London. We didn't go home at that time because both Felix and I were, my husband and I were working. And we were staying with, we went to the Seder at people who were very much involved in the refugee movement, a woman whose name I'm sure you know, you would know about, Anna Schwab, who was very much involved in the refugee movement. But the reason we went there was because my husband was a great friend of Anna's nephew, who came from Hamburg, and so we, as a young married couple, were invited there. His name was Harold Ellery, nay Heinz Ellen, and Felix, my husband, he met first day in the army, in the British army. And but to me, Pesach has always been very special. And as the years go by, I think that to me is one of the most important festivals. It points out also how very fortunate we were in getting out.
Did any of the National Socialist ideology percolate down to you as a child?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
What about the infamous Kristallnacht? Were you in Munster when that occurred?
Indeed. I remember that very clearly. My father went on a business trip to Wiesbaden. As I say, still a nucleus of an office at home. My uncle and aunt were getting ready to emigrate to Buenos Aires. And so we had Omi staying at our house. And we had at the house, we had this cook I mentioned before, Bolly, and a Jewish au pair, because you couldn't, you know. And again, some people sent their youngsters to Jewish homes so that they were prepared, if necessary, to get out to have some skills, household skills. I think this one was called Efi. I can't remember, honestly, which one it was. But I remember that my mother was having a meeting on that evening, on the 9th of November, in of the leaders of the synagogue, presumably what today would be called a women's guild or something like that, with my aunt and other people, to arrange for the Hanukkah party for us children later in the year. And Omi occupied our night nursery. My brother and I shared a room in those days, a bedroom. And I think my brother had a cold, so he was on the second floor in one of the maid's bedrooms, and I was actually in the room next to my parents' bedroom, which was a dressing room. And I was very proud that I'd been presented with an alarm clock with an illuminated dial for my birthday earlier in the year in June by an uncle and aunt, a distant uncle and aunt, who also didn't make it. So I woke up in the middle of the night to hear this terrible row going on. Looked at the illuminated dial of my alarm clock and realized it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And got up, went out, and I thought, the ladies can't be making that row. And got up and peered over the banisters and sort of down the stairwell without being seen. And there were, what seemed to me, I think there were several dozen people actually in the house, in brown shirts, and smashing the place up. But I scuttled back to bed, and shortly after that my mother came in and said, "Don't worry, darling, they're just searching the house." And in fact, I was in the dressing room where my mother's jewelry, furs, whatever she had, were, but they were all in built-in covers. So the drawer was thrown open and two of these geezers came in and said, "Oh, it's only a child here on a couch. Oh, there's nothing else here." So everything was built in covers except for mother's dressing table. And thumped out again. And Mummy said, "Don't worry about it, but go and lie on the other bed where Omi is," because there were two beds for my brother and I. And she brought him from upstairs to be there. And Omi was so doped up, because she just had surgery, that when two of these characters crashed in there, she said very politely, I'm saying it in English because it doesn't make any difference, "Good morning, gentlemen, I hope you're well," because she was completely doped up to the eyeballs. And then that lovely Bolly came in. She was normally terribly neat and tidy, you know, with one of those plaits at the back of her head very neat. In a nightie with her hair streaming down, I said. So I cried to my mother, who appeared again, saying, "You know, they're smashing everything up downstairs, and how dare they, and I know those boys." So obviously local boys, I mean local young men that she knew. And they ordered upstairs at gunpoint. And they're smashing everything up, and we had just had a large set of Rosenthal china delivered that morning. And they were smashing it up, and my mother said, "It's only china, forget it, forget it." And then she said, "But my things," my mother said, "everything that is damaged of yours, I promise we'll replace." And so then she came upstairs afterwards when these characters apparently left, I don't know. They smashed up, the cut open, smashed up, cut the settees open, and smashed the, you know, they really did a smashing job down there, if you'll pardon the pun. And Mummy said, "You're not to come downstairs, you stay on this floor." And she didn't want us to see this. And then apparently somebody stood at the window. Oh, in the middle of the night, London, by the way, my aunt arrived in stocking feet on a very raw November evening and immediately collapsed. She had come, they had a flat at the Max Eindorf Stiftung. You know, one of these long mansion flats, you know, the old-fashioned type of thing. You see them in London all the place as well. And because they had a non-Jewish maid who was terrified, they didn't set it alight, which they wanted to do, but flooded it. And my uncle was taken off in a car, one of the thugs' cars, I guess, and subsequently emerged, was driven around the community to identify his flock. I think they also broke his glasses, and he was very short-sighted, very thick pebble lens glasses. And my aunt fled across the town to us, and my mother couldn't get a doctor for him. Because as many of the doctors we had, I think were the GPs and whatever, were Jewish ones. So I think eventually she managed to get her obstetrician, who was a university man, and not Jewish, because he just couldn't get a doctor. They'd all been taken to the prison. But none of this, of course, we knew at the time, and this has obviously emerged since. But my aunt was in quite a state. And, of course, of my father, there was no sign. Nor had we expected it, by the way. And one of the things which no doubt you heard about from others is that nobody knew to the extent this sort of... They pretended, as you know, the analysis, that it was a spontaneous uprising. Nobody knew whether it was happening all over Germany or whether we, you know, this particular town or whatever. I do know that the very remarkable bishop of the town, a man called Garford Garland, warned my uncle that something was going to happen and tried to intervene and intercede. And he really was one of the Catholic senior clergy, one of the very few Catholic senior clergy who spoke up and preached against the Nazis in his pulpit, with the SS sitting at the back, But subsequently, the next morning, they burned down the synagogue and played puppet theatre with the scrolls, the mantles of the scrolls. And it was a nice synagogue, and which was very much, again, part of our life. And we heard about this, and people actually came, and people who used to work for us came and said, "What could they do anything?" Non-Jewish people. And so I can't remember who it was. Somebody stood at our window looking down the road. And because they'd gone to the Max Heinlerstift to find my uncle, he wasn't there. They'd gone to the synagogue, it was burned down. And then came home to my father. They wanted to know what the hell to do. And one by one, I think it was Zimboning, or my father's non-Jewish secretary, it was a very nice woman, who may still be alive, I don't know. Her name was Fräulein Hein. I don't remember what her first name was. And she married a Dutchman, de Boer, and we actually saw them after the war. They invited my brother and I to come over and spend a holiday with them. But they stood there and they watched the people coming towards my father's house to get advice what to do. And being picked off one by one. They were waiting for them. Because they knew they could work out that was going to happen. And they took them to prison. And during the course of the morning, I think, my father rang from Wiesbaden and said to my mother, "Is everything okay? Are you and the children okay? And is Omi okay?" And my mother said, "Yes, we're fine," because she didn't know what to say, because she'd seen these people being taken away. And she knew Fritz Steinthal was obviously in prison. Again, as I said before, one didn't know whether it was all over the country or not. So she said, no, we're fine, and the children are fine. And my father said, "Shall I come home now?" And Mummy said, "Finish your business, don't worry about it," because she didn't want him in prison. And that was the last she heard from my father for 10 days.